It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll explore the 500-year legacy of Latinos in America.
But first, it's time for our nostalgia segment where we look back at things from our past that still resonate with us today.
Our next guest caught a wave of nostalgia from a staple of the 1970s living room, the lava lamp. Believe it or not, the lava lamp turned 50 earlier this month, and although they're not quite as popular as they used to be, they still hold a special spot in our culture.
Kirk Baird is a writer and columnist for the Toledo Blade and recently wrote a column about his experience with the lava lamp. Kirk, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you had a recent experience with the lava lamp. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I was... To be honest, I was trying to think of a column idea, and I came across... actually, someone, coincidentally, on NPR had mentioned... They'd heard on NPR about the lava lamp's 50th anniversary, and I thought, you know what, that's a great idea for a column. And next thing you know, I'm getting out the lava lamp, I'm watching it, and then my daughter, who's six, comes in, sits down and watches it with me. And I'm just kind of caught up in the moment of it all, and I thought, you know, this is exactly what it was, you know, like in the 70s, and here it is, you know, whatever it is, you know, 30, 40 years later, and, you know, I'm still caught up in it, and so is my daughter. It transcends generations and decades.
I want to key in on a phrase you just used. You got out the lava lamp, meaning at some point in your history, you packed away the lava lamp. How long has it been sitting in the closet or the attic?
It's actually my wife's lava lamp. She bought it in high school, and it's been packed away, I would say, probably for 20 years, 20 or 30 years. So it was just sitting in the basement on a china cabinet, and I just thought, you know what? I'm going to get this thing out. You know, I had to get a new bulb for it. I had to plug it in, make sure it was still working, and it took several tries to get the wax to flow properly. But once it did, it was working as good as ever.
Yeah. One question is, how do you dispose of a lava lamp? Maybe that's why it was still
called
in your
the hazmat
cabinet.
Team. Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what that stuff is inside the lava lamp. What is it?
It's wax, and I forget exactly what the kind of liquid that's inside. Basically you just take the normal lamp or the normal light bulb, a low wattage light bulb, and it heats the wax, and so that it kind of floats. It's kind of buoyant, and then as it heats up, it, you know, of course it rises, and once it gets to the top where it's, you know, away from the lamp, then it cools down and then begins to sink again.
So your 6-year-old looking at the lava lamp, was she entranced by it, or was it pretty quick she wanted to get back to the Wii or whatever screen was lying around?
She was entranced by it, and that's what was so remarkable. You know, here she has, you know, myriad devices that she can, you know, pick up at any moment. You know, my iPhone, TV, you know, do all these things, and she just sat down and just kind of zoned out on the lava lamp with me. And it was just kind of this really kind of cool daddy-daughter bonding moment over, you know, this kind of groovy icon of the 60s and 70s.
So you said zoning out. Is that a good thing? is it like watching fish in an aquarium where it's fun for about 5 minutes and then it's time to do something more exciting?
Honestly, I think it was about 10, 15 minutes, and we were... We were never bored. We were ooing and aahing at some of the different formations and watching it bubble up and drop. It was a lot of fun.
So some things from the 70s went away. Some come and go, disco, some of the fashion. Has the lava lamp come and gone? Does it keep coming back into style, maybe not as much as it once was?
Well, that's what's kind of interesting. I mean, it does have a history of coming back. I mean, it's still made by the same company. It's been around for 50 years. It came back in the 90s for a bit, but, you know, it's still sold at, like, you know, Spencer's. You can still buy it online at lavalamp.com. It's, you know, unlike so many other fads of the 60s and 70s, this one has never really completely gone away. And I think generations still kind of embrace it from time to time.
So what are, going back to the wax bubbles, what are they floating in? Is that stuff just water? It looks kind of oily.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I don't remember off the top of my head what exactly that is. I think it is some sort of like an oil or something that's in it. It's not just, you know, it's not just straight water. It's something that allows it, you know, to kind of have, again, to have that kind of buoyancy, and also to, that it kind of retains the heat and helps it heat up, but also allows it to get cool at the top.
Oh, so, and getting, you know, those little bubbles of wax to move around in there requires heat, like you just said. So does this mean lava lamps are kind of a hazard and you maybe wouldn't want one in your two-year-old's room at night?
My wife was really concerned, especially given the age of her lava lamp, about heating this thing up. She was worried that it was going to burn down the house. It gets a little hot, the base, but, as long as you don't have it next to anything, flammable, I think you're fine. I mean, I had it on at one point for, like 8 hours, and I touched it, and it was hot, but it didn't burn me. I think you're okay.
Have you kept it out, or is it back in the basement now?
It is still out. We have it. I put it, much to my wife's chagrin, I put it in the niche over our fireplace.
Classy.
Exactly. And it's so, we had this little, little family statue, and I actually took that out and replaced it with a lava lamp. So it'll be there probably until we put up our Halloween decorations. Although kind of gold and red, it kind of goes with Halloween. So maybe I can keep it up at least through, maybe even through Thanksgiving.
Do you have any idea where this thing came from? Who invented it?
Yeah, it was a British accountant by the name of Edward Craven Walker. And, he was just kind of working on some things. And memory serves, he was kind of boiling some things. And then he noticed this kind of strange property with the wax. And he thought, this is kind of interesting. It's really kind of cool. And so he kind of, worked on it some more, perfected it. And then proceeded to sell it. And then, by the late 60s, early 70s, it had taken off and just, become, the big fad that it was.
Do you think there was something in the air in the 60s and 70s in our minds that made lava lamps so appealing?
I mean, if by air you mean, something, maybe.
Literally or figuratively.
I mean, I think it was just, it speaks to, a different time when people, were a little, things were slower. People could just, could just kind of zone out on something, and that's what I was so impressed with it now is that it did. I mean, it did sort of still resonate with my daughter and frankly with me. I mean, I'm a product of, the 2000s now. I mean, I keep my iPhone with me everywhere I go. And that's what I found somewhere. If I didn't feel the urge to pick up my iPhone and look at the 4-inch screen, I was fully focused on the lava lamp for 10 or 15 minutes, and I didn't miss not being connected with the world. I enjoyed having that kind of zen-like moment of just being there and just kind of just enjoying what was going on.
So you found the antidote to our screen-filled culture, the lava lamp.
Exactly.
Maybe. I kind of associate them with bachelor pads and not necessarily unsavory things, but sort of that cheesy shag carpeting and, in a young guy's place. Is that unfair? Were they more egalitarian than that?
I mean, I remember them, from my grandparents, my parents had them. And then I think it sort of did kind of, maybe unfairly develop this association as, this kind of, in the bachelor pad, type setting. But, yes, when I was a bachelor, I did have a lava lamp myself. It was just kind of, it was decorative and it was kind of fun. But I mean, again, I don't want to call it family entertainment, but it is. I mean, it's something everybody can just kind of sit down and enjoy. It's actually, and even if it's just kind of like a sort of in the background, just kind of running, kind of doing its thing, it's still a nice little distraction. And people, I had a neighbor come over over the weekend, and he looked at it. He said, "Oh my God, it's a lava lamp!" And he kind of freaked out about it, and he was really excited about it. So I mean, it still catches our attention. People still really are into the lava lamps.
Kirk, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
We've been talking lava lamps with Kirk Baird, writer and columnist for the Toledo Blade. And if you have a lava lamp story, if you have a picture of one functioning in your home or workplace, go to the Central Time Facebook page and share it with us.
What kind of workplace is that?
I don't know. Well, I've heard there used to be one in the What Do You Know offices till a certain person knocked it over.
That's the problem. All right. Well, coming up next, it's part two of our series on the 50th anniversary of the Gideon versus Wainwright Supreme Court ruling. And then we'll take a look at the history of Latinos in America. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
In part two of our series on the 50th anniversary of the Gideon versus Wainwright Supreme Court ruling, Gilman Halstead reports on how the historic decision led to the creation of the Wisconsin Public Defender System.
I said I want you to appoint a lawyer to represent me in this trial. I'm entitled to a lawyer.
Mr. Gideon, I'm sorry, but I cannot appoint counsel to represent you in this case.
That's Henry Fonda portraying Clarence Gideon in the 1980 movie Gideon's Trumpet, Hollywood's tribute to the Supreme Court ruling that established the right to a court-appointed attorney. 50 years later, here's what a public defender sounds like in a Milwaukee courtroom. In this case, a homeless defendant is charged with graffiti and starting a fire in a trash can.
Brian Hagner on behalf of Mr. Thomas Melinda, who appears in custody. Mr. Melinda is currently homeless and without a phone number. He is public defender eligible. I did review both criminal complaints with Mr. Melinda, advise him of his rights, and we enter a plea of not guilty.
Wisconsin's Supreme Court had established the right to a publicly funded attorney in all felony cases in 1859, long before the Gideon ruling. Walter Dickey teaches law at the UW-Madison Law School.
Wisconsin's got a broader right to counsel than the United States Supreme Court has granted.
But before the Gideon ruling, and for 15 years after, it was the counties who paid for attorneys. Dickey says the way it was enforced varied by county.
I remember one western Wisconsin county. There was a lawyer had 80 appointments in 1 year, and not a single trial. The obvious worry was that people were being appointed who rolled over, and it was really more about efficiency and moving the cases than it was about, you know, the fair administration of justice.
But that changed in 1979 when the state public defender's office got funding to provide lawyers for poor defendants in almost all the counties. And by 1985, every county had a cadre of public defenders. Last year, the agency handled more than 130,000 cases and is on track to handle even more this year. Wendy Doherty of Superior says the system worked for her. She says without a public defender, she likely would not have been acquitted for a charge of operating under the influence.
I mean, I could have with my trying to testify, you know, but there, I needed that lawyer there to do that for me. I mean, he had all the research down and knew all the language and had all the photos and, I mean, saw that there could have been a mistrial because things were not being done right.
The head of the state public defender's office, Kelly Thompson, says there's strong support for the current system that ensures that people like Doherty, who can't afford a lawyer, can have one. She also says public defenders ensure that trials run more smoothly.
They can't function when people are there who have mental health issues, who have drug and alcohol issues, who have educational barriers. The law's complicated. It slows everything down. You know, the judges are, it's hard for them to have someone there, I believe. I think it's hard for district attorneys, Department of Justice, to be on the other side when people aren't represented by counsel. So I think everybody benefits.
But Thompson says there's still room for improvement. In 2009, the legislature boosted the public defender's budget and changed the poverty guidelines, increasing the number of people who qualify to have a public defender. But there are still people who fall through the cracks. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Gilman for that report.
Tomorrow, Gilman reports on why some defendants still end up in a courtroom without an attorney and the efforts of reformers to expand the public defender system to include people who face civil charges like eviction or welfare fraud. It's Latino Heritage Month, and today more than 50 million Latinos live in the United States, comprising a significant part of American culture and history.
In his new book, Latino Americans, which accompanies a new PBS series by the same name, our next guest chronicles that history and challenges us to think differently about the cultural fabric that weaves America together.
Ray Suarez is senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour and author of Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. Ray, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Will you tell us why you're calling this the Latino moment?
Well, I think a lot of people, including people who are even in the business of demography, weren't expecting the 2010 census to tell us that there were more than 50 million Latinos living in the country. And that was one of those wake-up moments, along with school systems across the country, in places you'd expect and places you wouldn't expect. to have one out of every two of their incoming kindergarten class be Latino. One out of three teenagers in high schools across the country. It is a sort of cross-hatching set of circumstances coming together. Not only the places you predict, like Miami or Los Angeles or New York, but places that are less predictable, like Lumberton, North Carolina, and Dalton, Georgia, the Yakima Valley of Washington. Latinos are on the scene. They're the new kids on the block, and it's changing the country.
Well, if this is Latino moment, as you say, it's been a long time coming. Why has Latino history been pushed to the margins over the years?
Well, you know, if it's true that the winners get to write the histories, well, you know, a lot of the people who had a part in drawing the map of the United States as it is did it by either buying out Latinos or just pushing them out of the land with force of arms or force of money. So while Mexico or the Spanish Empire was a part of 23 different states of the U.S. Union, we tend to play down that part of our past. We tend to forget that part of our history. And if you're sitting on a choked expressway between San Diego and Los Angeles, you're not thinking about the fact that those are two Spanish names, and there's a reason for that.
Well, it's interesting for me on a personal level. I'm Latino. My father was from Mexico. And growing up in rural Wisconsin, I never met anyone else who was Latino. They all thought I looked weird. And at the time, I would lie and tell people I was Portuguese or something. And now I look around me and there's lots of people who look like me. So what changes when a community of people become acknowledged in the mainstream and claim their history and are seen more fully?
Well, the first thing that happens is the majority gets a little uncomfortable. And I think in some of the tone of the discussion about immigration and assimilation that we're having now in the United States, you can hear a little bit of that panicky tone. And that's unfortunate because people have been coming here since the 16th century and making the place what it is. And Latinos have been here since the very beginning and arrived yesterday. And that's unlike any other group. And, you know, if you want to be honest about who's picking your strawberries and your lettuce and babysitting your kids and cleaning up after your elderly in home care situations and in nursing homes across the country, doing drywall and laying sod in new subdivisions, a lot of the work that gets done in the United States every day is done by some of those 50 million hardworking people. There are plenty of other Americans working hard too, but instead of becoming part of the party, we're still held a little bit at arm's length. And this history, I think, is for both groups of people, both Latinos who know a little bit about their history and want to know more, and other Americans who want to integrate this history in what they already know about America.
Now, the PBS series and your book capture 500 years. That's an incredible scope. How do you go about trying to trace that much history?
Well, the short answer is it's really hard. You're constantly making these terrible choices about leaving this in or taking this out because you can't write an exhaustive history. It has to just be a survey to give people a handle on the story. So we picked, the television team and I, a group of people who represent the Latino state in America as history moves along. So during the Depression and World War II era, during the 19th century when the United States is arriving in what used to be Mexico, in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, as Latinos are joining the spirit of the 60s and launching their own civil rights movement that in many ways mirrors and takes its inspiration from the Black civil rights movement. These are all moments in history that tell us something about the country at large, but also tell us something about the Latino community at that time.
Now, you're talking about a Latino civil rights movement, and I think a lot of people would be unaware that such a thing had happened, unlike the Black civil rights movement. Can you make the case for, you know, when that happened and what happened?
Very similar to Black Americans, when Latino GIs came back by their hundreds of thousands when the war was over, and people came back from the defense plants and doing civilian work on the bases. They had just helped the United States beat fascist genocidal regimes in other places in the world and helped give other people back their freedom. And they came back to the Rio Grande Valley, or they came back to Fresno and San Joaquin and Phoenix, and found that they had a separate set of schools, lived in divided communities where there would be the town, and then there'd be the Mexican part of town where there was no indoor plumbing, no modern sewerage, no updated water systems.
And we're going to have to leave it there for now, Ray, and pick it up in just a moment. We're talking with Ray Suarez, author of Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation.
You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 with your questions and experiences. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with PBS's Ray Suarez about the series Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation, and his companion book by the same name.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you see the influence of Latinos in America? Do you have a question about the role they've played in American culture or the history? Or do you have a personal experience, maybe an immigrant yourself, a recent immigrant, or you could talk about your family's history? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Ray, before we heard the news there, you were talking about a Latino civil rights movement. Do you want to pick up where you left off there?
Well, they had come back, the veterans, from winning the Second World War, and were not inclined to live as second-class citizens after going and bringing freedom to countries around the world. So they began to agitate for voting rights, better access to education and housing, better facilities, public access to infrastructure like sewers, like highways, and it went on from there. The GIs were the seedbed from which both the Black and Latino civil rights movements grew, and they took different forms in the East Coast and the West, but they were fighting for many of the same things.
Now, you mentioned World War II, and you know, a large chunk of the book is dedicated to that. There's lots of incredible stories. There are many that we probably haven't heard in standard school texts so far, anyway. And one tells the story of Eugene Calderon, who had an incredible contribution during the war. Could you tell us his story?
Eugene Calderon was a fascinating guy. He comes out of Spanish Harlem in Upper Manhattan. He was a gang boy. He was getting into trouble. And to stay one step ahead of the law, he enlists and goes away and becomes a man in the service. But also experiences some of the ambivalence that the United States has about mixed-race people, because he signs up for the Army Air Corps, is quartered with white troops who say, what's he doing here? He's not white. And when he's assigned to the Tuskegee Airmen, the Tuskegee Airmen say, what's he doing here? He's not black. He's a Puerto Rican guy from New York. He goes on to use his GI benefits to get an advanced degree, becomes one of the first Puerto Rican upper-level managers of the New York City Board of Education, becomes one of the founders of several of the most important cultural institutions for Latinos in New York City. And it's just one of those stories where a kid who was headed nowhere fast goes through this amazing experience of the war and has his life reshaped by it and goes on to make a tremendous contribution in New York City.
And how was he treated when he first came back?
Well, his son tells the story of Eugene going back to the police precinct where he had unfortunately spent a lot of his teenage years, and they still had outstanding warrants for him. But he went in there to tell them that he was now signed up in the police academy and was going to be an officer like them. And he goes on to found the Association of Latino Police Officers in New York City, which does a lot of the work fighting for the right to take officers' exams, to become sergeants, to become lieutenants, and which had been largely closed to minority applicants. The ranks of the upper management levels of New York City Police Department, like many departments around the country, were virtually closed to black and brown applicants. And Eugene Calderon had a hand in that as well.
What history lessons did you come across, strands of Latino history, that were revelatory even to you, and you thought, you know, people really need to know about this?
The thing that struck me again and again was how difficult America was finding it to accommodate these people. And at the same time, Latinos don't become a country within a country. They don't become a separate culture, alienated, checked out of the rest of the United States, but keep coming back and keep coming back and keep participating and keep pushing ahead. And it's really touching, in a way, to see this tremendous desire for acceptance and love of country that keeps pushing the community forward, at the same time as new arrivals are coming all the time and making it a not quite clear-cut picture. Who are these people? How long have they been here? Well, the answer is since yesterday and 500 years. And you're just going to have to wrap your head around that, America, because both things are true with both sets of problems, both that desire for acceptance as a people long in the country and the need for a different kind of help because you just got here.
You know, we know a lot about Japanese internment camps during the war, but I hadn't heard some of the stories about how around that same time, Latino families were, you know, quote unquote, sent back to Mexico. And some of these kids had never been to Mexico. They were Americans, and yet they were sent back. And that's not a story you hear very often.
Thousands of mixed status families were sent back to Mexico during the Depression. The Secretary of Labor and the heads of the various immigration agencies and state governors got together and decided one way to solve their near-term unemployment problems was to simply round up large numbers of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans and send them back south of the border. It was a crazy time. America was obviously really frightened of the Depression. It was capitalism having a nervous breakdown. When you hear about things like the Okies heading west and finding armed officers at the entrances to California, turning people back, these are not things that you think, well, wait a minute, that can't happen in America, can it? Can someone in a uniform with a gun tell you you simply can't enter California? That kind of thing was happening, as was trains being loaded up with eventually almost 500,000 Mexicans and Mexican-Americans and sent south into Mexico, and those people told not to come back.
Do you know what happened to most of them? Did they stay there, or did they try to re-enter eventually?
Well, you know, it's a very mixed picture. Some do eventually re-enter because we go from labor oversupply during the Depression to labor hunger during World War II. So some people filter back. Those who were older but also American-born had an easier time making their way back because of their added facility in English, their ability to get the papers they needed to demonstrate their citizenship. But a lot of people were just swept up and sent back and stayed there, even though many could establish their legal right to live in the United States. And as I mentioned, the country ended up needing them just a few years later, once the war is in full swing.
Let's see if we can get one call in. We have Pat joining us from Grafton. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I am a first-generation Italian-American, and I know that we haven't had as much discrimination as Latinos, but, you know, there's a lot of similarities, and, you know, so that story does resonate with me. And my father is Irish-German and was from Northeast Wisconsin, and, you know, eventually we were accepted by his family, but, you know, his grandmother had a hard time with the marriage. She considered it, I guess, a mixed marriage of sorts, and she had a problem with my wearing earrings and my Italian grandmother living with us and so on. But, you know, eventually to keep a relationship with us, she became to be a lot more accepting and so on. So a lot of this does resonate a little bit, and I know that some of the history is very similar, and it's been a very good broadcast. I've enjoyed listening to it.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Pat. Appreciate that. And Ray, you know, are Latinos in America, have they faced, you know, the similar trajectory of other immigrant groups like Pat was just talking about, or is there something different about this experience?
Well, I think the primary difference, and thank you for your call, is that when you look at the immigration patterns of the Germans, of the Irish, of the Italians, of the Jews of Eastern Europe, there was a run-up, an enormous spike, and then a subsidence. With all, you know, the years may have been different, but the pattern was the same. And then large numbers stopped coming, and the country digested what was here already. And that was certainly the case in the United States during the 20th century, where we rewrote the immigration laws in 1925, slammed the door shut after the stock market crash in 1929. Then we had the Depression, the Second World War, and recovery in Europe in the 50s. So people stopped coming. Those were years of very low immigration. So those people who came before the door was slammed shut, their families assimilated. Their families learned English and forgot the languages of their home countries in many cases. And the number of foreign-born got down to a very low level by 1965 when we rewrote the immigration laws once again and threw the door open to the rest of the world, not just Europe, the traditional source of American immigrants. So people began pouring in from new places, different places. So this latest experience of immigration has been a little different one from the one that we had from 1870 to 1920, where millions, 80 million people eventually had either were immigrants themselves or had immigrant parents. We digested those huge inflows from Europe in part because we stopped taking new immigrants. But the pattern with Latinos is different, and they came in large numbers in the 70s. They came in large numbers in the 80s, then again in the 90s. Then even until the wheels fell off the economy with the Great Recession, were still coming in large numbers until then. It's just a different kind of pattern. You don't have that spike and then a subsidence down to nothing.
Well, the series has just started airing. What kind of reception is it getting so far?
So far, so good. The second installment is on tonight, so if you're near a TV, please do take a look. The war years and the years just after are profiled, and the Cuban refugee flow and so on. So we've got some great stories to tell tonight. The reception has been very good, and a couple of people have complained about an anti-American tone, and some people have said we've exaggerated the trials and challenges that have faced Latinos over the years, but the historical record is the historical record. It speaks for itself, and there's nothing anti-American about a country that has taken on these people, not always been so happy that they're here, but once it gets used to the idea, is changing, absorbing, and reflecting the fact that we are a changed people. We've done that over and over again. We've been here before. So there's nothing anti-American about reminding the rest of us how hard it can be to come to this country from somewhere else in the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That was Ray Suarez, author of Latino Americans, the 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation. And you can catch that next installment of the PBS series, Latino Americans, tonight at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Television.
Coming up, we'll take a look at changes to Badger Care, why 92,000 people may soon lose coverage. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. Enrollment in the Affordable Care Act's federal exchanges starts next week. Ahead of that, Wisconsin's Department of Health Services is notifying residents that there are some serious changes ahead.
And many of these changes have to do with the state's Badger Care program, where over 90,000 people are expected to lose coverage under the plan and require them to seek out a commercial health care plan through the exchanges.
Joining us now to discuss what's going on with health care in Wisconsin is Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
So we mentioned over 90,000 people on the Badger Care program getting letters this week that their coverage is ending. Did we know this was coming?
Right. We knew this was coming because the governor was one of the governors who refused to take the federal recommended expansion. The expansion in the Affordable Care Act goes up to 138% of the federal poverty line. A court case on the Affordable Care Act said that the federal government could not make this mandatory, and that's what gave governors a choice. And the governor of Wisconsin decided not to take this choice and to move it down to 100% of the poverty line.
So representatives of the Wisconsin Counties Association said yesterday, hey, Governor Walker, take this federal help, expand Badger Care back to these people who are being knocked off of it. Do you think there's any chance of the governor listening to that and doing that?
No. Given what he has said, he is not going to do it. It's more ideological because of the fact is that the expansion of the Medicare, the federal government picks up 100%, the total tab, for 3 years, and then it gradually goes down to 90%. Normally, in terms of Medicaid in Wisconsin, it's actually 58% that the federal government picks up. So this is substantially more than the federal government normally picks up. So the state of Wisconsin is losing a lot of money.
Well, Governor Walker's case in declining it was that, hey, we can't be certain that it's going to continue to be there, the money from the federal government. And we see a filibuster or something like a filibuster maybe starting in Washington today, a vote in the House to defund a lot of the funding we're talking about here. Is Governor Walker right to be leery about making commitments to use federal money that maybe could dry up in a couple few years?
Well, no. It's basically illogical. Because what he's doing is he is telling these individuals to go on the exchange. And how could they go on the exchange? Because there's federal money there. There's federal subsidies. And so, in fact, is that they would, on the exchanges, they would be dependent upon the federal government, too. So he's removing the risk for the state of Wisconsin and putting the risk on everyone else. And even with the state, it's not a risk, because if the federal government didn't, and I don't anticipate that would occur, but if the federal government didn't provide the money for this, it's all the state of Wisconsin would say, well, we're not getting the federal money at that time. We would have to revert to 100% of the poverty line.
On a technical level, what is different for someone in a state like Wisconsin that declined this money and isn't setting up its own health exchanges, and somebody in another state that is taking an active role in healthcare exchanges? What's going to look different to them?
Well, the exchanges themselves, if the state was running the exchanges, the state could make determinations about a number of decisions with regard to the exchanges. What we've done is we've essentially let the federal government make all the decisions for the state of Wisconsin on the dimensions of the exchanges. And so there is a certain basic package of insurance benefits that must be covered. But in states that are running their own exchanges, they will make different decisions as to what should be covered. Another example would be some states have decided that they did not, because people are poor, these are relatively poor people, that they did not want to allow insurance companies to charge more for smoking. That's one of the items that an insurance company can charge more under the Affordable Care Act. But the state could make a decision not to do that. And a number of states have made that decision, but Wisconsin can't because we're not running the exchange.
So the Affordable Care Act is being phased in over time. Some of it, as I understand it, is in place already. A lot of it isn't. What's the big next step? It's the people can start applying next week. Is that right?
Right. Right, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the Affordable Care Act, as you mentioned, is, for example, implemented. Children can stay on their parents' policies to 26. Pre-existing conditions for children cannot exist. No coverage limits, for example, are already in existence. What is occurring beginning next year are the exchanges you mentioned, and that is a big one, and the individual mandate, requiring individuals to have insurance. But the other thing that's occurring as of January is that an insurance company cannot deny insurance to individuals who have pre-existing conditions. Children were covered almost immediately after the Affordable Care Act was passed, but adults were not. And these individuals can now buy insurance.
Governor Walker said actually just earlier today he thinks the president might delay implementation of the individual mandate part of the Affordable Care Act that you just mentioned. The piece I saw just before going on air today actually said no response from the White House on our question about that yet. Do you think that's a remote possibility even?
No, I don't think that's a possibility because there was a bill in the House to delay the individual mandate, and that passed the House, but it did not pass the Senate, and the president indicated he would not sign that. The reason for the delay there, or one of the reasons the argument was for delay, is that the president did delay the business mandate, that large businesses over 50 had to provide insurance or pay a fee. That was delayed because businesses needed more time to organize it. Many businesses provided, so we're only talking about a really small number of businesses that actually fall into this category of not now providing insurance. So it was a very small number, about 6%. But they wanted a delay in that. So the president did delay that until next year. And some of it was it's not so much money, but some of it had to do with the procedures that businesses would have to use to verify that they provided the insurance. And they wanted those revised. So that was delayed a year. And so a number of Republicans in the House, particularly, then pushed for the delay of the individual mandate and the Democrats said no, and that didn't take place.
In about 30 seconds before we head over to our news break, do you think there's going to be a bumpy ride as the bigger parts of the Affordable Care Act get implemented?
Well, there's going to be some problems. I mean, any large bill, I mean, you can look at whether you're talking about the recent drug benefit, or you go back to Social Security. Any bill has some problems that are not anticipated, and there's people getting around them. There's always ways of people trying to flaunt the system. But over a period of time, incremental changes will iron out those. And I doubt that the big pieces are going to change very much.
We're talking with Ed Miller about changes to health care in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you. What's your reaction to these Badger Care changes, people getting letters that they'll have to leave the system and apply under the new marketplace? Are you someone who's being dropped? Have you gotten that letter? What will this mean for you? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you have a question about the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Stick around. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.